This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. If you like stories about famous people behaving badly, it's a good time to be alive. And we have some recommendations this morning in our segment Word of Mouth. Tina Brown, editor of the Daily Beast, suggests reading we shouldn't miss. So we're talking here about notoriety and about celebrities behaving badly. And you begin with an article about the choices that celebrities might make that would allow them to get away with such things or not.
Absolutely. Well, of course, you know, this is the season for celebrities behaving badly, it seems. So I thought I'd obviously have to begin with Tiger Woods, because on the Daily Beast, the former call girl, Tracy Kwan, offers extramarital dating advice to Woods from one top-ranked professional to another. Her view is that Tiger's biggest mistake was dallying with amateurs who didn't subscribe to the call girl code of protecting, above all, her client's secrecy.
Like journalists protecting their sources.
So exactly right. I mean, she makes a really quite valid point that Ashley Dupre, the prostitute who was exposed when the former New York governor, Elliot Spitzer, was busted, she never actually offered him up to anybody until the time came when the press and law enforcement blew the whole thing wide open. Before that, she'd protected his secrecy like the state secret.
And so the advice here that's being given to famous people who want to misbehave is go deal with a professional rather than someone who will get emotionally involved and get angry at you later.
Yes, absolutely. She really accuses Tiger of vanity. She says that, you know, he was a fool to trust these women because for them it wasn't a business arrangement. It was all about having a dream of moving up and being arm candy to a celeb. And of course, once one girl, you know, is exposed, then all of them come out of the woodwork.
You have also sent us an article from your former magazine, The New Yorker, Annals of Law, The Celebrity Defense by Jeffrey Toobin.
Jeff Toobin is a wonderful writer, but this piece, I think, is one of his best on Roman Polanski because he very coolly dissects the impact that celebrity has had on the vicissitudes of Polanski's whole course with the law in the last 33 years. The rape that he's accused of course, took place in the late 70s. He skipped the country, went to live in France, and ever since, of course, has been trying to come back to the United States without facing justice. And he was only recently apprehended, as we know, in Switzerland just a couple of months ago. And the question really is, why was he suddenly arrested after all this time? And Toobin makes the case very persuasively that he was only arrested because, in fact, for the first time, he was getting close to having his whole sentence sort of repealed. And it was because he was near to getting it actually concluded that the DA decided it was time to arrest him before that happened. What is fascinating, and that is what's so clever about Toobin's piece, he shows how at first, you know, celebrity really worked for Polanski, but then it turned against him because basically antagonized the judge, who really himself was a big showboat. He allowed Polanski to go off and do a working assignment. Polanski went off to Germany, and very, very unwisely, he was allowed himself to be photographed carousing one night in Munich during the Oktoberfest with a rather glamorous young woman, and that picture appeared in the papers, and that picture made the judge absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy. He felt that Polanski was flouting the judge's authority, and that really set him on the course for the second round, where, in fact, everything was really weighted against him. There's no doubt that probably today he would have been given a very light sentence and got out.
So basically, the lesson here is that if you're a celebrity, you can get special treatment as long as you keep it quiet.
Very, very well put.
Now, you do have another article here that you call our attention to, CNNmoney.com. Why Kozlowski Should Get Clemency. Dennis Kozlowski. Remind us who he is.
Well, Dennis Kozlowski was that wonderful kind of comic business fraud, really, who was the CEO of Tyco. And 7 years ago, he was convicted for really, in a sense, looting his company. And he's been sent to jail where he's been sitting mouldering in the Mid-State Correctional Facility in upstate New York, really, for the last 7 years. He's got an 8 to 25 year sentence. I mean, Kozlowski, I think, captured the public imagination because of the famous $6,000 shower curtain in his Manhattan apartment. And this writer, David Kaplan, says, compared to a lot of the villains we're seeing in the last sort of economic meltdown, it's almost as if Kozlowski is kind of small fry. I mean, he almost seems quaint. He was just a common or garden fraud looting money. Nothing actually collapsed. You know, Tyco is still standing. So here's Kozlowski sitting mouldering, and Kaplan says maybe he should come out at this point.
Because he's not as bad as certain bankers, we can name.
Because he's not as bad as certain bankers. I have to say that I think that 7 years is enough time for Dennis. He's not going to hurt anybody. They should let him out.
I wonder if this is another example of that double edge. While he was famous and powerful and seen as successful, he thought he could get away with anything, and he did for a while. But once he was caught and became this notorious poster child for corporate malfeasance, he was going to be harshly dealt with.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it is so interesting here. This is the common thread between all these people who fall. It is this hubristic thing where they just feel they were above the law. I mean, it's so clear in the Polanski story that he just really didn't feel that he was doing anything wrong. You know, he was just giving this girl quaaludes. He was giving her champagne. And of course, you know, then suddenly there's a moment of a reality check where they're confronted with the real world and they just can't handle it. Certainly true in Kozlowski's case. He really did think that it was going to go on forever. And of course, with all these CEOs, they're surrounded by yes people all the time who they think that they can do anything. And they all make the mistake of thinking that the DA is someone they can treat like the help. That's their mistake. It's certainly true in Polanski's case with the DA, and it's certainly true, really, I think, in Kozlowski's case. They always think they can blow off justice, and of course they can't.
Word of mouth from Tina Brown. Tina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can find links to all the stories we just talked about at our website, npr.org.
And now, like all her predecessors, Disney's latest princess is a beautiful young woman with an angelic voice, a puffy pastel ball gown, and in the end, of course, she finds her prince. But as you probably know, Princess Tiana is Disney's first African-American princess. The animated film, The Princess and the Frog, debuted in selected cities last week. It hits theaters nationwide this weekend. As part of our Talking Race series, we've asked Dawn Turner Trice, who writes the Exploring Race column for the Chicago Tribune, to talk about the film and about reaction to it. If you've seen The Princess and the Frog, what did you think? Does her race matter? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Dawn Turner Trice joins us now from Chicago Public Radio. Always good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Neil.
And what'd you think of the movie?
Well, I loved it. I went to a special screening on Saturday with my 14-year-old daughter, and we both loved it. I was shocked. I was pleasantly surprised. I thought it would be a damsel in distress Disney princess movie, and it absolutely wasn't. She's strong. She's beautiful. She's smart. She believes in working hard, and she's self-sufficient. And I thought that the message, and you know, you have to have a message with a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. And I thought the message was solid, and it wasn't syrupy, and it was a good movie. It was a good message for the time.
And was her race significant?
The movie isn't about race. Her race is not a major factor. There are some racial overtones in the movie. For example, it's set in 1920s New Orleans, and you can't escape the race element there. Very early on, you see the two distinct worlds that are black and white. Tiana spends time with her mother at her employer's home, and the mother is a seamstress. And on the way home, Tiana's looking outside the window of a trolley as the opulent white world dissolves into kind of the squalor of rundown shacks that's her neighborhood. But and so you see those two distinct worlds. But there's a closeness and a richness there in her community, and often people gather on the porches and commune over lavish meals. And she learns that you can recreate that sense of community in a restaurant, which is her her goal and her dream that's bequeathed to her from her father. So there are some racial, some of the language is cultural, and some of it is, it's not just racial, but it's kind of, it's part of the New Orleans culture, but it's all woven into the story so that it's not so so intrusive.
And it's interesting, this is not Disney's first non-white princess. Mulan, Jasmine, Pocahontas have been featured in previous animated films, yet a lot of people saying it's about time.
It's interesting. I've heard a lot of people, blacks, whites, Asians, say that it is about time. But you know what we have here is a character who will really, I think, stand on her own, and her skin color is just a part of who she is, and it doesn't make her who she is.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking about the new Disney movie with an African American princess. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Tiffany's on the line with us from Leavenworth in Kansas.
Hello. Yes, thank you. I just, you know, had a comment regarding, you know, it is about time, and it seems, you know, that, you know, in my opinion, Disney's kind of late, and I'm happy, you know, my daughter and I will go to see it once it's out, but it's refreshing and comforting to know that the next generation of, you know, young African-American girls to come up can actually see something that I didn't get to see, you know, and I think it'll be good for them. And I just...
One more barrier down.
Yeah, pretty much. One more, you know, better late than never. But it's definitely a good thing. And, I mean, race isn't an issue, which is why I don't understand why there haven't been more, you know, different race princesses or characters, you know, in Disney or any other, you know, production company. But it's a good thing, and I'm glad.
All right. Well, have a good time at the movie, Tiffany. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You know, Neil, I think that when people say it's about time, they're giving Disney kind of this this weight, or it's like, well, there's a validation that's kind of implied there. And I don't know. I find that I understand why people say it's about time, and I appreciate it. But I find that a little disturbing in that, you know, until Disney puts it out there. It's not valid. Yeah.
It's also interesting in your piece in the Chicago Tribune, you wrote that this film has attracted a specific demographic.
Yes. Before I arrived at the theater, I had been talking to some people, colleagues, friends, and even readers, black women, middle-aged black women. I'd say black women maybe over 35 years old, and middle class. And these women were you could see the twinkle in their eyes when they were talking about going to see this movie. And it occurred to me that, some of the women weren't necessarily mothers. They were taking nieces and, you know, planning to take nieces and maybe neighbor friends or something. But it occurred to me that there is that something that has carried over from maybe childhood back when in a time when, you know, little black girls, it was almost the furthest things from our imagination to think in terms of being a princess or even a Disney princess.
Disneyfied princess, yeah.
Yes, yes. And so that this is welcomed to them, and it is historic, and it's a big deal. And I was even in the theater. I was sitting not far from a group of women who were I would say they were as captivated by this movie as maybe the children who accompanied them.
Well, let's talk with Sadiqua. Sadiqua with us from Tallahassee.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't have any girls. I have little boys, and I am, like those women, I suppose, excited to see it. I'm in my 30s. And I don't think it's about I don't think that it's per se that if Disney doesn't validate it, it's not validated. But I think it's more about branding. We all know the branding that Disney do, and we all know the effects on the self-esteem that branding can do.
So
think it's about time in that context.
And are you going to take a small child as cover?
I'm definitely looking for a little girl to take, and I would like to take black and white.
Uh-huh.
And my family, we aren't necessarily allowed, if you will, and it's common in the black community. You can't buy, like, I have a niece, and if you're going to buy her anything, it can't have a white face on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not too strictly not about white people. It's about the branding aspect. Like, she sees that already on TV and everywhere else. And so we need black dolls. We need black princesses. And so I think it's about time in that aspect. But I'm very excited about it. I'm very excited that they put Carol's daughter with it to get the product, which is another. She's a sister. So I'm very excited about the whole concept of it.
Okay.
And you're talking about the merchandising. There's a lot. Of course, it's Disney, and so there is that line. There's a line of beauty products
right.
that will accompany and dolls and other and clothing that will accompany Princess Tiana, the brand.
Yep.
Sadiqua, have a good time.
Thank you. I will.
Go ahead.
You know, Neil, there's a generational difference here as well. And I do believe that younger kids, as I said, I went to the theater with my 14-year-old daughter. And I think that younger girls, and whether they're black or white, but specifically black girls, I'm not certain that they're really getting the same or feeling that same level of intensity of that this is such a historic event because, you know, they live in a world in which they've got two little princesses in the White House, in Malia and Sasha Obama. And how they view themselves, it's not perfect, but it's very different from the way that their mother their parents viewed themselves coming up in terms of beauty and body image. So I think that while they appreciate Princess Tiana, she's kind of part of their existence these days. You know, it's like it's no biggie.
Now let's go next to Donna. Donna with us from Cincinnati.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am one of those middle-aged black women, and when I grew up, of course, you know, we didn't have a black Disney princess. Well, now I have a daughter who's 8 years old, and I intend to go and see the movie with her to make it sort of a girl's day out. But I think it's important on more than one level because, you know, when you have a daughter who doesn't really have a positive image in the doll selections that she has, and she has all the other Barbie dolls, or the other Disney dolls,
mm-hmm.
And we have her collection, and I've decorated her room with them, and she has Jasmine, Princess Jasmine, but she doesn't have Tiana as of yet, and I obviously plan on adding that to her collection, but I think Disney did a great service to black women and girls by doing this because, you know, yes, we do have the Obama girls in the White House. However, they don't see them all the time. When they come home and they're in their room playing, they're not playing with those kids. So they go to schools, and my daughter goes to a predominantly white school. So she needs a positive image when she's playing with dolls and looking for toy options. So I just want to thank Disney for that.
All right, Donna. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Don, we just have a few seconds with you left, but the prince in the movie, well, for most of the movie, he's a frog, but he's green.
Yes.
But he is not
black. They both
black.
Are, actually.
Yeah, they both are, yeah. But he is not black, and does that turn out to be important to people?
Well, it may be important to some. It has been important. Some people have commented about that. But I think what's really interesting, at least for me, was that Tiana had such a strong father figure, and he was such a huge presence in her life, like her first love. And I think for me, that kind of, it doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter anyway. But I think that it does kind of water down the whole notion that we don't know the race of the prince, but he's not African American. But I think that it's in keeping with the theme of this movie in that, you know, race really kind of, it's not all that important. You don't know the race of the alligator or the firefly. They have a certain dialect, but maybe it's that that they're black. Maybe they're just of New Orleans. It's the accent there. So I kind of like the melding of that, the race Dawn. Issue.
Dawn Turner Trice writes the Exploring Race column for the Chicago Tribune and appears on this program regularly. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
She joined us today from Chicago Public Radio, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation coming to you from NPR News.
Tiger Woods is more than just a championship golfer. He's a brand, and a big brand at that. With multi-million dollar endorsements, several video games built around his image, all kinds of memorabilia, and a foundation for children that bears his name. But the golfer now faces mounting problems, and there are questions about just how much the Tiger Woods brand is worth right now. Journalist Duff McDonald tried to answer that question on the Daily Beast website, and he joins us now to talk about what he found. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this being the holiday season, you looked first to an interesting place to assess the worth of the Tiger Woods brand. You went to the toy store and looked at the shelves. What'd you find?
What we found was that Tiger action figures in Toys R Us in a number of cities were all selling for about 33% off, and maybe even more revealing, had been moved to certain parts of the stores that were not for prominent or high-selling products. They were more of the clearance sale type.
Is this just in one store, or did you find this all over the country?
Oh, all over the country. We sent out some reporters in California, in New York, and in Washington State, and in a number of them they found the discounting. In one store, one of the store employees said they hadn't even heard of a Tiger Woods action figure and actually responded, "Is that a gag gift?" So it was a collection of data points, not just a single one.
What about video games?
Video games, Electronic Arts, which is the biggest maker of video games and has done the Tiger Woods PGA golf franchise for years, told us that they're fully behind him, they support him, et cetera, et cetera.
What about sales?
They wouldn't give us anything on that. We had reporters go to some of the video game stores, and apparently those are not suffering any decline. And I would guess that's because if you are a gamer and you want to play golf, it's actually the top game there is. So it's one of these weird things. Like, it's the Tiger brand, but it's kind of like Madden football. It's not really about Madden or Tiger. It's about if you want to have a golf video game. So far, from what we could tell, there wasn't much of an effect there yet.
Well, what's going on with people who collect Tiger Woods memorabilia? Price up, price down there.
Well, that was probably our most interesting finding. We talked to some sports authenticators, and we also talked to some auction houses. And turns out, you know, this was news to me, that there are people who had six-figure value collections of Tiger memorabilia. Who knew? And apparently one of them has put his on sale because he's so disgusted. So
the whole thing.
He's out. As far as the rest of them, what we heard was that the dealers in this kind of stuff are so skittish right now. It's kind of reminiscent of the credit crisis a couple of years ago when you could get no bid for your product. Why bother selling it? So the dealers aren't even bothering to try and move Tiger merchandise. They said, we're just going to sit back and wait till the dust settles here because there really isn't a bid.
What's going on with endorsements?
It's hard to say what's going on with them because those are all private negotiations. As far as the public statements from his major sponsors, Nike, Gillette, Accenture, these guys are sticking behind him. Gatorade, it looks like, may have discontinued a line of Tiger drinks, although an announcement out of them today suggests that, or that at least they'd have you believe that this was a decision that was made long ago. But it's hard to say. He's probably going to hold most of his major endorsers, and I think that we're going to get back to focusing on the golf and the dominance there, and we're just going to see one of the most dominant careers in sports continue.
Well, Duff McDonald, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Journalist Duff McDonald is a contributor to the website The Daily Beast. He joined us from New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Here's a reunion I'd like to be at. Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, and Jim Belushi will be among dozens of Second City alumni gathering in Chicago this weekend to celebrate the theater's 50 years of funny. The first Second City performance took place a half century ago. NPR's David Shaper reports on how a little storefront comedy theater became one of the most influential in the nation.
What's most impressive about walking into the Second City's small lobby are the walls. You go up the stairs toward the bar, and the walls are full of pictures depicting five decades of Second City's comedy.
If we come over here to this wall, this is sort of where it starts.
Second City owner and executive producer Andrew Alexander shows off pictures of casts and skits from December of 1959 through today.
You see a ton of great people, Fred Willard, Robert Klein, David Steinberg, Minor Cole.
Hello, God. God, it's me, Noah. N-O-A-H, Noah.
That's Alan Arkin at Second City back in 1961. Arkin would go on to win an Oscar for his role in Little Miss Sunshine, playing alongside another Second City alum and one of today's biggest TV stars, Steve Carell. From the beginning, the Second City has always been an unparalleled incubator of talent. But serving as a Midwest farm team for the Hollywood and New York big leagues was far from what the founders planned. At the University of Chicago, they'd played in a comedy troupe called the Compass Players and wanted to capitalize on the growing counterculture movement.
Second City came out of the 50s when there was more of this conservative mother-in-law type comedy going on.
Chicago Sun-Times entertainment reporter Mike Thomas wrote the book Second City Unscripted. He says while Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Shelley Berman, and a few others took on the establishment with biting satire in stand-up, Second City's ensemble work was unique.
Nationally, for a long time, Second City was really the only place people could come to see and to be involved in this sort of satirical, improv-based comedy.
Improv is essential to Second City. Making comedy out of a simple object shouted out by an audience member, as in this 1997 sketch with Tina Fey.
You have been listening to an excerpt of the Polynesian Banana Dance. And this is WBEZ Chicago, National Public Radio.
Wait a minute. Making fun of NPR is nothing sacred? At the Second City, no.
Well, we certainly don't shy away from controversial topics. I mean, that's often what's interesting.
Second City director Matt Hovde.
Second City has a great history of dealing with, you know, sort of edgy sexual issues and political issues and racial issues.
Hovde and others say the key to Second City success is to be both funny and relevant. And Second City performers do so relentlessly, 8 shows a week, 52 weeks a year. Owner Andrew Alexander says that Second City alum have not just gone on to success on screen, but behind it as well, as producers, directors, and writers. He says that's because Second City performers are creating and writing their own material.
Here you get to develop your own character. You really get a chance to really develop your point of view. So you become a multi-threat.
Many here cite the freedom to try new things and fail as a critical element to their success. Author Mike Thomas calls the Second City the Harvard of ha-ha. Tough to get into, grueling to get through, but potentially huge. The Second City brand has expanded far beyond the Windy City. Second City Toronto has been a fixture for close to 40 years. There are 3 traveling troupes that tour the country and a training center that offers improv classes to 2,000 students per session. It's all part of a growing $30 million comedy empire. But director Hovde insists Second City hasn't lost sight of its roots.
Night after night, live on stage, we put up, you know, a 2-act sketch comedy review that's going to poke some fun at the way the world is. And it always comes down to that for us.
And that, he says, is how Second City plans to thrive for another 50 years. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.